This is Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. Last summer, Massachusetts lawmakers set some ambitious goals for offshore wind energy generation in the Commonwealth. This summer, Governor Charlie Baker is calling for more energy storage capacity. Later this hour, hear about the technological options for energy storage and where those stand. Also, you've probably heard that the bacteria in your gut are important to your health. In the past several years, research has shown that your microbiome, as it's known, can influence everything from metabolism to immunity to mental health. Hear from a scientist trying to figure out how. How do your gut bacteria talk to the rest of your body? We start, though, with a truly heartbreaking story. In the past 2 weeks, 7 North Atlantic right whales have been found dead near the Gulf of St. Lawrence, and another 3 have been seen entangled in fishing gear. There are only about 500 North Atlantic right whales in total, and the species is severely endangered. So losing this many animals is a setback. And adding to the tragedy, a human life has been lost as well. A Canadian man, Joe Howlett, died last week while freeing a right whale from fishing gear. Canadian and American officials have suspended disentanglement operations to assess what happened. Joining me now to talk about what all of this means for the future of North Atlantic right whales is Mark Baumgartner. He's an associate scientist at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution and head of the North Atlantic Right Whale Consortium. Mark, welcome to the show. I wish it were under better circumstances.
Me too.
Let's start with the animals who have been observed entangled, still alive. Three whales entangled at this point with disentanglement operations temporarily suspended. Is this a death sentence for these three animals?
Well, entanglements can last for a long time. So unfortunately, we may get, or fortunately, we may get a chance to have a chance at disentangling these animals. It's been suspended in the U.S. I don't know how long that's going to last, but hopefully it will be lifted after the investigation. The disentanglers can get back to their very important work.
And the 7 animals who have been found dead, what do we know about what killed them?
So 3 of the animals have been towed to shore, and they've performed necropsies on those animals. There are 2 more, I understand, that have beached and are being, and necropsies have been done, but the preliminary results are not out yet. For the 3 that have been necropsied about a week and a half ago or 2 weeks ago, the preliminary results suggest that one died from chronic entanglement, and the other 2 had signs of blunt force trauma, which is usually broken bones. The results of the final results of the necropsy won't be available for another 6 to 8 weeks, and it won't be until then that there's a final determination as to what killed the animals. Blunt force trauma is certainly consistent with a ship strike death.
The area where these whales are right now, in and near the Gulf of St. Lawrence, is this a normal area that we would find right whales? And if so, what is different about this year?
So we don't actually know if this is a normal area for them to go. We know that right whales go to the Gulf of St. Lawrence. It's only in recent years that there's been an increase in research activities there. But right whales have been shifting their distributions, and there's a hypothesis that right whales are using the Gulf of St. Lawrence more than they have in the past. There's still some research to be done to determine if this is a new behavior for them or something that they've always done, and we've just noticed it because we're spending more research effort there.
If they are going there newly, is that likely to be a result of climate change, or what would cause them to be in a new area like this?
It could very well be. So right whales have been changing their distribution. We don't see them as often in the places that we used to see them. Here on in Massachusetts, we would see them in Cape Cod Bay in the wintertime. They still come to Cape Cod Bay, but they would also go to the Great South Channel, which is an area between Cape Cod and Georges Bank. I'd done research for many, many years in the Great South Channel, and there were years where right whales just wouldn't even show up. And that's happened in the last about 8 to 10 years. So we know right whales are changing their distribution. This change We don't understand it very well, but it could very well be caused by climate change. We know that the Gulf of Maine is changing rapidly. It's warming very, very fast, and the species composition is changing. We know that, for instance, the lobster industry in southern New England has essentially dried up. And that's, we think, is because of climate change. So it makes a lot of sense that right whales would be responding to that change because they feed so low on the food chain.
If we assume for a moment that this is new for right whales to be, at least so many of them, to be congregated up in the Gulf of St. Lawrence area, what makes that area so dangerous that seven of those individuals have now turned up dead within a two-week period?
It's the same danger that right whales face throughout the east coast of the United States and Canada, and that's ship strikes and fishing gear entanglements. There's snow crab gear. There's been several documented cases of right whales being entangled in snow crab gear in the Gulf of St. Lawrence. And there's a major shipping lane that goes into the St. Lawrence Seaway that goes through that area. It's not clear that those right whales, if they were hit by ships in that shipping lane. There is other shipping traffic, but we just don't know enough right now.
When North Atlantic right whales are here in the Cape Cod Bay area, as they usually are in the springtime, they face a lot of the same threats. There's a shipping channel into Boston, and there's the lobster fishery with its gear and ropes. But we have certain protections in place, right?
That's
correct. There are speed limits. There are restrictions on the lobster fishery while right whales are in the area. Are there any of those sorts of protections while these animals are in Canadian waters?
None. So there has not been a concerted push to implement similar protections for right whales in Canadian waters. But I can tell you that the Canadian government is very serious about right whale conservation. They were before this happened, and I can guarantee you they definitely will be after.
When you're thinking about the trajectory of a population, the mortality rate, the deaths, are half the equation. But the other half is births. And unfortunately, there's not really much good news on that front for right whales either. Birth rates have been pretty low, what, maybe five calves observed this year. Do we know why the birth rate has been so low?
We don't. There's two possible reasons. One is environmental, that the animals just aren't feeding enough to for any mammal, females need some sort of fat reserve to be able to bring a fetus to term and then to be able to feed that calf or baby. In the case of right whales, we think that the shifts in distribution might be indicative of something going on in the environment, and those same environmental factors may be influencing the whales' birth rates. Another important thing to consider, probably not the whole story, but perhaps part of the story, is the chronic health effects of entanglement. When whales get entangled, even if they get disentangled, either get out of the gear themselves or are disentangled by people, the health effects of those entanglements go on for years. And we know that females that get entangled are not as don't have as many calves as females that don't get tangled. So that may be part of the picture too, unfortunately.
We know that North Atlantic right whales are extremely endangered and the population has been in decline. But this year, the math is particularly
horrible.
Yeah. Seven dead in the last 2 weeks, three entangled. That's 2% of the entire population. It's twice the number of new calves this year. And scientists that I've spoken to have said things like, we haven't seen this many whales die in such a short period since the heyday of whaling. One said, I'm concerned that we're watching an extinction event. Do you share those concerns?
I do, absolutely. So you're forgetting there was a ship-struck right whale just off the coast of Massachusetts in the spring. So that's eight known deaths. There may be more, but known deaths, and only five calves produced. So we know this is going to be a year of decline. And it follows what the research suggests is several years of decline. So the important thing to remember is this is a population of maybe around 500 animals. There's different population estimates, but one's 525 and the other is 450. So these are very, very small numbers. Think about the last time you saw 500 people in a room. It probably wasn't that long ago if you went to a Red Sox game or, you know, 500 is just a tiny, tiny number. And what we worry about as scientists is that things can go badly for a population of such small size very quickly. And one of the populations that we point to is the Gulf of California harbor porpoise, or the vaquita. The vaquita, 20 years ago, there were over 500 animals, just like North Atlantic right whales. Today, there are only 30 vaquita left. And that their numbers plummeted because of illegal gillnet fishing off the coast of Mexico where they live. Not to say that right whales and vaquita are the same. The issues are somewhat different. But it's just a reminder that a population that's so small can go south very, very fast.
Is there a way that this could turn around for right whales? Is there any cause for hope in this situation right now?
Absolutely. I think that there are measures that have been proposed that could help significantly. One of the things that has changed over time in the fishing industry is the amount of rope in the water and the strength of the rope in the water. So one of the proposals that has been put forward is to kind of turn back the clock in terms of rope strength. Back in the 1990s, ropes were about half as strong as they are today. And the thinking is that whales could get out of those ropes once they got into them. They could break free. Right whales are big and they're strong, and they can break through a rope that's of low breaking strength. So in the 90s, we didn't see such severe entanglements as we do today. And research by the New England Aquarium is suggesting that the reason that we see such severe and fatal entanglements is because the rope is so strong. The animals get into it and they can't get out of it. The rope wraps around them and it becomes a really complicated, long, and ultimately lethal entanglement. So a very simple idea is to just use rope of reduced breaking strength. And that's something that's being pioneered by fishermen right here in Massachusetts. The South Shore Lobstermen's Association has come up with a method to reduce the strength of their ropes, and that's fantastic. Our researchers from the New England Aquarium are having rope manufacturers actually manufacture rope of reduced strength. So that's one thing that we're trying. Another thing, a little farther off in time, but we think that there are ways to fish without actually using rope. And we call those ropeless fishing techniques. And we are basically borrowing techniques that the oceanographic community has used for a long time to put instrumentation on the seafloor and then get it back without having to have a rope attached to it. There's some development to be done, but it's very promising, and we want to see that become a reality.
That's Mark Baumgartner. He's an associate scientist at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution and head of the North Atlantic Right Whale Consortium. Mark, thanks for coming in.
Thank you, Heather.
We're going to shift now to the Pacific Ocean and a much happier story. Amy Fleischer is a teacher at Nauset Regional Middle School, but for most of July, she's part of a team exploring California's Channel Islands National Marine Sanctuary, mapping the seafloor aboard the exploration vessel Nautilus. She spoke to us by phone from the ship. Amy, welcome to Living Lab Radio.
Hello, thank you for having me.
First of all, where are you right now?
Right now, we are in the Channel Islands National Marine Sanctuary off the southern coast of California.
And what is the goal of this particular mission aboard the Nautilus?
So this region is a marine biodiversity hotspot. So one of our missions is to document and sample the incredible array of wildlife here. And we're also interested in finding paleo coastline. So about 20,000 years ago, we were in the last glacial maximum. This was a time when the ocean water was bound up in glaciers, so the sea level was a lot lower, about 300 meters lower. So we're mapping the Channel Islands to see where the paleo coastlines were. Where were the ancient submerged coastlines? And those coastlines have particular features that we can look for. If you think about the beaches that we see today, you see like high energy systems, lots of wave hitting the shore. So wave and wind abrasion is causing weathering and erosion, and it creates sculpted features like canyon walls, sea caves, spires, and arches. When we look at the paleo coastlines in the Channel Islands, we're looking 300 meters below sea level for those same features. So we're on the hunt for submerged sea caves.
Wow. Okay, that sounds cool. You've got 24 teachers, not just yourself, an artist, 19 students that are all out there. And you guys are standing watch and actually helping the scientists with this mapping and with this mission. What kinds of things have you guys been doing?
Well, I stand watch 4 hours on, 8 hours off. And my goal is to learn as much as I can about the science that's going on the ship, to be talking with the mappers, to be talking with the geologists, the biologists on board, and absorbing it all and communicating that via telepresence to the world at large. So we stream live audio and video every time we do an ROV dive, and I'm helping to communicate that science to the rest of the world. We also do live interactions here in our television studio aboard the EV Nautilus, and so I speak to museums and school groups across the world about the science happening here.
How much training did you get before you hopped on board this ship and started teaching the world the science that you're doing right now?
Well, this is my second time on board. I first came out for an expedition in the Gulf of Mexico in April of 2015. Before that expedition, we got a week of training at the University of Rhode Island's Graduate School of Oceanography, and I came back this year as a lead science communication fellow and helped with training the new group.
This mission looking for paleo coastlines sounds like, you know, it's a nice parallel to a lot of things that we hear about and learn about here on Cape Cod, of course, formed by the last glaciation event. How do you plan to bring what you're learning now back into a Cape Cod classroom, say, this fall?
Well, that's the exciting part. Everything that we're doing out here directly relates to the curriculum that I'm teaching in grades 7 and 8. Our theme in grade 7 is energy systems, and we actually study kinetic energy followed by weathering, erosion, and deposition, the impact of short time scale processes on the Earth's surface, and then we follow that up by studying how Cape Cod was formed on a long scale process through glaciation. So everything we're doing here is directly applicable to what we're doing in the classroom. We're also connected to the 8th grade curriculum where we study climate, so understanding how temperature and precipitation have changed throughout the world over time, as well as actually genetics, because they came up with a brand new technology that we're piloting here on the EV Nautilus called eDNA. We're collecting water quality samples from around deep sea coral colonies, and we're hoping that there will be sloughed up cells of all of the organisms that live in that area in the water, and we'll be able to study the genetics of those cells to figure out what organisms are present. And this is a really exciting way to diminish our impact on the ecosystem, because usually we would go down and collect samples, but we don't want to take things from the bottom of the ocean if they can live and thrive down there. So eDNA is this really exciting opportunity, and it directly relates to the genetics unit that we're doing in grade 8.
You're only a week into this 3-week expedition, but I wonder if there have been already surprises or aha moments, discoveries that have surprised the scientists themselves while you're out there exploring these deep sea environments.
Well, there's definitely a lot of excitement on board. When we find a canyon wall or a sea cave, that's exciting. When we find an organism that we haven't seen before, last year when they surveyed this area in 2016, they found a gleaming purple orb, and they had no idea what it was.
I remember that, actually. That went viral on the web.
It did, absolutely. One of the great things about being on the EV Nautilus is we can only have about 31 members of the Corps of Exploration on board at any time because of the size of the ship. But we have scientists around the world in our science chat that are constantly watching live with us and talking back to the scientists here on the boat, helping us to identify what's going on the seafloor. And they were sort of postulating what it might be, but eventually we sent it to Harvard's Museum of Comparative Zoology, and in order to figure out what it was. And it turns out it's related to a snail. It's a snail with a very small shell, and that with a mantle that covers most of it. So on this particular journey, we've seen a lot of cool creatures. We saw a fish eating a fish eating a fish. We saw a ghost shark. We've been visited by blunt-nosed six-gill sharks. And from the surface of the vessel, we've even seen a blue whale.
That sounds awesome. Amy Fleischer is a teacher at Nauset Regional Middle School and right now an educator at sea with the exploration vessel Nautilus. Amy, thank you so much and good luck on the rest of the cruise.
Oh, thank you so much.
You can follow along with Amy Fleischer and the exploration vessel Nautilus at nautilus.org. You can also find a link at our website, capeandislands.org. Up next, as more renewable energy comes online, we need more capacity to store electricity for later use. Batteries are just one option. Where energy storage technology stands, When Living Lab Radio continues after a short break.